Good afternoon, and welcome to Our Recourse, a one-hour radio show named in honor of the Immaculate Mother of God, hosted by Brian Gale. As Pope Francis says, Jesus Christ is the mercy of God. And as our beloved church has long taught, His Mother is our ever faithful recourse to that mercy. So sit back for the next hour and enjoy Our Recourse with Brian Gale.
Good afternoon and welcome. I am Brian Gale and this is Our Recourse, as you just heard, a one-hour radio show named in honor of the Immaculate. As Pope Francis says, Jesus Christ is the mercy of God. And as our beloved Mother Church has taught for so long, forever actually, His Mother, our Lord's Mother, the Immaculate, is our ever-faithful recourse to that mercy. We've got a great, great show for you today, an incredible guest. I can't wait to get to it. Before we do, I just want to remind you that this show is brought to you, as the others this month have been, by Murtaugh Brothers Construction and Stucco Remediation. Paul Murtaugh and his wife, Teresa Flanagan, just terrific, terrific people, have done so much for so many here in the Archdiocese, and we'll talk more about what it is they do specifically and can do for you momentarily. But let me talk to you about our guest. Let me at least get a good introduction. Dr. Julie Azuzu, I'm going to pronounce that right, Azuzu, is probably one of the most remarkable human beings that you will ever read about or hear about or actually hear speak, and she is here to speak today. She has written a book called Every Child is a Blessing, Saved by an Angel of Light. And in it, she tells a story that I'm going to coax her into telling, and she's agreed that she would tell at least parts of it today to you, that is the most incredible story I think I've ever heard in my entire life. Let me just say, by way of outline, it begins in Biafra with a war with the Nigerians when they entered that country to take it over for the oil. She was about 4, 5, 6 years old at the time. And to bring you up to the present moment, not only has she got an undergraduate degree, not only does she have a physician's degree, a medical degree from Penn State University, she's now studying, in addition, to be a lawyer at Ave Maria, one of the top Catholic law schools in the country down in Naples. She also happens to be a mother of 8 children, and she has written, I think it's like 10 or 11 different books. As I said to her over the weekend when we were previewing this, I said, do you ever sleep, Julie, ever? We're going to ask her that question again because I'm here now to welcome the remarkable Dr. Julie. Dr. Julie, thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you, Brian. It's my honor and pleasure to be your guest today. Everything you said is correct, but it's very difficult for a person to hear their story being told the way you just did. I see myself as very humble and just doing, I believe, what the Lord has called me to do. And that's just a reflection of the things that you've listed.
Well, you've got a couple of messages that we want to get to. Obviously, we're going to get to the narrative itself, the outline of the story. Our listeners would crave to hear that. But the fact that the real secret is the faith that has generated the trust, that has generated the persistence, that has generated all the blessing and the tremendous success that you've had and all the obstacles you've overcome. One lesson, but also an equally important lesson, and you made this point over the weekend when we talked, the absolute lie of the pro-abortion industry and people, that pro-life people really only care about you having your child, women like you, and that after you've had the baby, they could care less what happens to you. And you're going to tell a story, part of your story, which puts that to the lie. And I think every single one of our listeners is pro-life, and they know that it's a lie, but they love hearing firsthand from people, credible people like you, that there are pro-life people who stand by ready to help anybody and everybody at any point along their journey to having that child. And I want to make sure we get to that point too, and I also want to make sure that our listeners are able to get know how to get your book, which we have ordered copies of and have here at In His Sign Network, and how they can go on to your website and read about your remarkable story in more depth, and also see all the other great motivational books that you've written that are prepared to be published in some cases, that are really available to them to bring them hope and the same kind of blessing, please God, in their life that you've had in yours. But let's begin at the very beginning. You are a little girl. You're 4 or 5 years old, and you are asleep in your home in Biafra with your dad and your mother and your brothers and sisters, your siblings. And describe what happens next.
First, I want to correct that those were my grandparents. As you remember, my grandparents, yes, they raised me from when I was barely 3 months old. So those individuals were my father, meaning my grandfather, my grandmother, and my uncle, who were present at the time. So basically, as you very well said, it was between 1967 and 1970. At that time, Biafra was a country by itself. And as you rightly said, there were economic issues regarding the source of oil, which at that time was the major economic revenue source. There were not confusion, but argument, and as you said, greed for oil. And basically, all the negotiations failed, and eventually, a war ensued. And I was literally a kid. This was between ages 4, 5, 6, and 7. And just sleeping, and the next thing you hear is the blast of bombs. And it's very difficult for a child to describe that. But in this book, I was able to really go into the mood and emotion that I experienced and describe what I felt. So millions of Biafrans were killed in this war, up to 3 million of them.
3 and million?
Then,
wow.
1 million of them were children who were systematically starved to death.
Just an astonishing story. Rwanda. Some years later, the same kind of thing. Doesn't it strike you as just outrageous that the civilized world allows these grotesque, these holocausts of murder in the southern hemisphere, and even sometimes in the northern hemisphere, and does not step in, does not do anything about it?
You know, I believe this is all politics as usual, as they say. There are things going on now in Syria, many corners of the world, that are people being killed, innocent people, innocent children. And politics is just basically what doesn't allow people to get involved. However, I must mention that there were organizations that are still active. In my case, the Red Cross. In spite of the fact that, you know, the Western world couldn't get involved because this was technically a British issue between Nigeria and Biafra. Hmm. So America couldn't really get involved and other countries couldn't really directly get involved. So Red Cross became a very integral part of that process. And I benefited from that because we found the food and medical help and resources that Red Cross provided, I don't believe that I would have been here today talking to you and your audience. So there are still organizations, there are still people out there who can do something in spite of the fact that politics seems to ignore this outrageous killing of innocent people. I still will continue to encourage those people who are willing to do this to continue and just never let go, because these people that you will save, these children that you will save, you just never know. They could also be the ones who will save others in the future.
Well, that's a beautiful and positive way to look at it. When you've survived something that 3 million of your countrymen did not, and 1 million of your fellow children did not. But let me ask you about another image that stuck out to me indelibly in reading the book, and that was you're taking shelter along with your family and extended family in a,
underground bunker.
An underground bunker, yeah. It was like only 20 feet long, 10 feet wide, 6 feet deep. You had plants and vegetation over it to shield you from rain and sun and things like that. I mean, what was that like? How long did you live in that bunker?
Actually, the bunker was a safe place for us to be. Remember, during that type of war, that the war is brought to you where you reside, meaning in that case where the Biafrans resided, the bombing was almost consistent. And the only way that people were able to get away from it was to go dig that underground bunker and go there, you know, as soon as they hear the sound of these fighter jets, you know, hovering and coming to do nothing but to kill them. So that bunker, although it wasn't ideal, it was clammy, it was cold, it was anything but a home. But at that point, that was a home because that was where we felt safe. There were times we spent days, depending on how long the bombing lasted.
Wow.
But then we'll come out to, you know, do whatever that needed to be done for survival, and only to just run back in there, you know, whenever that we hear the sounds of the fighter jets coming. But yes, it was a horrible, horrible experience, but you got to look at it this way. It was the source for survival. It was where we had the hope of surviving.
Yes.
And we tolerated whatever that discomfort was so that we could get a chance at life, just like I do. Now,
not to dwell too much on it, Doctor, but you know, you had enough food and water, you said, and other essentials to last for a while. So you guys were ready. You replenished things, so you were very resourceful. You collected raindrops in containers during rainfalls for drinking. You bathed and washed using muddy water, but you purified it with something called aluminum sulfate.
Yes.
Which, when added to the dirty raw water, miraculously created these clear, potable pools of water that you could actually drink from.
Exactly.
Very resourceful people. How long a period do you recall that was? You're living in that bunker.
Again, I think the whole duration of the war, which was 3 years, off and on, I remember I was a child, and my memory, as much as I pushed to, you know, remember a lot of the details, but my recollection is that we spent a reasonable amount of time in there. However, we did come out when, you know, there was no bombing or no sign of those fighter jets approaching. We would come out of the bunker, but just as soon as we heard them, we would go back in. So I would say, for the most part, off and on, maybe the whole entire duration of the war. And then, of course, when we, towards the end of the 3 years, then, you know, we didn't need to go in there again because we kind of felt that things were abating and looked like that would, you know, be an end to the struggle of the fight or whatever we were going through.
And, Doctor, you're right that you never really knew as a child, even after that, when the jets would return. But you did return to a daily life. You did go to school. There was a school, as you write. And by the way, the writing is just magnificent, absolutely magnificent. I just urge our listeners to call in His Sign Network to get this incredible book, Every Child is a Blessing. But you're right about big oak trees and a thick forest, and that's where you went to school, so that you could learn without being visible and really bombable. What was that like?
You know, my grandfather was a teacher. I did mention that later. He was a headmaster. So first I was aware that the war was going on, but going with my grandfather to school actually was a little bit natural, because I felt like he was there to protect me, which he always did. But now, of course, retrospectively, you look back, you know, the idea of being persistent, the idea of saying nothing is going to stop me, nothing is going to stop my children, nothing is going to stop my grandchildren from achieving this goal of education. And I think that is really an amazing quality in those parents, for them to actually encourage education in spite of the life and death situation that they were facing. So I really commend them for that, because when you look at this, if they didn't do that, people like me and people like all the, you know, success stories from that environment, from that culture, from that war, wouldn't have had the opportunity to be educated. So I really commend the parents who we are able to be persistent and say, in spite of what's going on, our children are going to get educated, because we believe that this is a way out for them.
Now, Doctor, I know both your parents, actually. You get to this at the end of the book. We're very strong-willed, and I know that, you know, there was an unfortunate separation there that was required, I guess, because of circumstances within the family. But who do you get? Where did you get this extraordinary persistence that you have?
I got it from my grandmother. My grandmother was one of the most persistent person that I ever came across. Of course, she's dead now. May her soul rest in the Lord. But she was very persistent. And in the book, I write about her being one of the women in my village who actually built a fence around our house. And this was something that she was bent on doing, even though my grandfather told her not to do it. He will make arrangements to do it.
Yes.
So she did. But unfortunately, when she was done building this wall and plastering the floor that looked so beautiful, it rained that day. And
yes,
my grandmother would not give up. The next day, she went to the market, and she got more bags of cement and sand, and she molded more blocks, and then she set them again, and this time it didn't rain. And from that one single act, I learned from her that whatever it is that you're doing, that you must never give up. If you say this is what you're going to do, then you must remain persistent. And there's a story there also about how she taught me the power of persistence. It's a very lengthy story. I don't know if we'll have the time.
Oh, Mr. Cabrero. Yeah, Mr. Cabrero's house, the man that owed her money.
Yes, definitely. Mr. Cabrero was called Cabrero. He was owing my grandmother some money. And so one morning, I was 8 years old, my grandmother called me and she said, I want you to go to Mr. Cobra's house. Tell him to give you the money that he owes me. So I, you know, 8-year-old, happy, jolly, dancing, going to the man and hoping that I'll just go there and give him the message and he'll give me the money. When I got there and knocked on his door, he came out and he asked me, he was a very big man, and he asked me what I wanted. I told him, I said, my grandmother wants me, you know, wants you to give me the money that you owe her. He looked at me and he smiled and he said, go home and tell your grandmother I do not have that money now. So I slowly walked out of his house. But instead of going home, I stayed outside. A few moments passed by. I went back to the door and I knocked for the second time. He came and he came out and he looked at me, you know, confused. Nothing. And he said, didn't I tell you to go home? I said, yes, you did, but my grandmother wants you to give me the money that you owed. For the second time, he told me to leave and tell my grandmother that he didn't have the money. So for the second time, I walked out of his house. But, you know, guess what, Brian? I didn't go home. I stayed outside, and then I came back the third time. And he looked at me. He was mad. He was upset. He was almost looking angry. And before he could get any word out, before he could say anything, I looked at him right in the middle of his face, and I said, sir, my grandmother wants you to give me the money that you owe her. Mr. Cobra, this big guy, he stepped back, paused, looked at me, and he said, I guess you are not going to leave my house unless I give you this money. So he reached down into his pants pocket, got the money out, gave it to me. I took it, ran home, and gave it to my grandmother. Now, the thing was, I knew that if I went home without that money, my grandmother would probably whip me. So I didn't want that, you know. I wanted to just go home and show her, hey, I was persistent and I got this money. But the point of this story is, Brian and the audience, anything you want in life, any goal you set for yourself, any dream you want to achieve, you must be persistent. And what is persistence? It's the ability to remain consistent in whatever goal that you want to achieve until it is actualized. You know, I heard a story about how and I forgot the name, it just escaped me. But it was the statement of putting a stamp on an envelope, and the envelope quits on you.
Yes.
So you have an envelope, and you put take the stamp. It's a very important document, and you want to mail it out. But then somewhere along the process, the stamp says, you know what, I'm not going to do this. I'm too tired. I'm too frustrated. I can't continue. What is going to happen to that vital document, Brian? It would never get to its destination.
Right.
And that is similar to us human beings. When we have a goal, we have a purpose, we have a dream, whatever it is that we want to accomplish, we must remain persistent. And really, one of the quotes that I really love is the quote by Senator Bradley. And I did mention, you remember that quote in my book?
Yes.
Ambition is the path to success, but persistence
is the vehicle
you arrive in.
Yeah, beautiful.
Ask yourself, how are you going to arrive? Defeated? Failed? No. No child of God failed, Brian. None. You believe in God, you have that faith. You go for that dream, you pursue that goal, and you never quit until you actualize the goal and the dream.
Julie, how old were you when you came to America, and how did you get here?
I was 16. I was 16 years old. I graduated high school when I was 15. And after graduation, I was very lucky to get a job as an international flight attendant. That job gave me the opportunity to come to this beautiful country, the greatest country in the world, this country that has given me everything that I have. And it was through that job that God opened the door for me to be able to get here, pursue my education, and actualize all these things that you mentioned at the beginning of the show. And I am so grateful for all of that.
Who did you come with? Did you come alone?
I did, actually. I came to go to Cheney University of Pennsylvania, which is not too far away from where you are, near Westchester University.
Yes. And how did you end up getting into Westchester? How did you end up getting into college?
Well, first it was my job that gave me the opportunity to come here. So the first time I came here was in New York, the flight attendant job. Later there, I had a long, I think it was just somebody who was a family friend who was a professor at Cheney. Mm-hmm. And I had many years before that mentioned to him that I would like to go to college. And when I became serious about it, I contacted him and he gave me the information. And I did all the application and I got accepted.
How old were you?
Oh, God, I probably in my late teens, early 20s when I started my first year of pre-med. Which was my biology degree.
Now, is that where you met your husband, or had you met him before that?
I had met him before that. We knew we were high school sweethearts when I was in high school back in Africa.
So he came, did he come before you or after you?
He came to join me, but it was a plan we had, because I was here and we had that plan that, we will go ahead and get married, and we did. And it was beautiful, and our 8 children came from that union.
Well, yes, I remember at one point you had 2 children, and you discovered that you were about to have a third. You were in school. You were working 2 part-time jobs. Your husband was working at least 1, I think actually 2 jobs himself. And there was a crisis because you were just barely making it with 2 children, and now all of a sudden God had given you a 3rd child. Tell our audience, our listeners, what happened at that point.
That is really one of the most beautiful stories, if I can classify. I know everything I've shared so far sound very beautiful, but this particular story you just mentioned is one of the stories that I'm so very grateful to God about. I was a student at Cheney University. My husband was a student at Temple University, and we had 2 very young children. After the birth of the last child, which is the second one, we requested for birth control assistance. Retrospectively, they wouldn't give us the access of birth control, but they instructed us on natural birth control methods. Now, you have to remember at this point, I was 23, my husband was just a few years old.
I just want to clarify, that's natural family planning, right?
Yes.
Natural family planning.
Yes. Yes, it is natural.
And it was a Catholic hospital. It was actually Misericordia Hospital, wasn't it?
You got that information from somewhere. I didn't have that in the book, but you're right, yes.
Okay. Well, I was born there.
Oh, really?
70 years
That's
ago.
Amazing.
69 years and 11 months ago, this very day, I was born there.
Oh, my God. Happy birthday.
Well, in a month, yes.
In a month, yeah. Happy birthday in a month.
So I'm very familiar with that hospital, yes. But anyway, go ahead. Yes. You were saying you couldn't get an abortion.
Yes. We couldn't. And I thought, I was just mentioning that we were young, we were naive. And about barely 6 months after the birth of the last child, I found out that I was pregnant. This was something that we didn't want to happen. Of course, that's why we requested that assistance. And at this point, we didn't know what to do. We could barely support the 2 little ones that we have. As you said, we were working, going to school. And one of the decisions then was, we have to abort this child. I don't believe that any mother, and it could be, and again, I know there's a large audience listening to what I'm saying, but I think mother's role is that of nurture.
Yes. Yes.
However, there are circumstances that could change that, and this happens to be one, and most of the situations are usually financial, social, they do talk about medical, and Dr. Sayu will be the one, I haven't mentioned him, but he's coming in this story. will be the one that could discuss in detail whether there's any indication of a woman needing to abort a child because of medical conditions. Is an area that I don't like to dabble into, which is very controversial, just like a lot of the topics that we're talking about today are. So we made the reluctant decision that we will get abortion. Unfortunately, I had code fears, so I backed off. There's a lot of details in the book, which is really one of the reasons that I encourage a lot of people to get this book and read, because the details of what happened at this particular time, is I was able to really put all of that down in the book.
Well, so I would just like to interrupt and say this for our potential readers and our listeners. It is so realistic, and the good doctor holds nothing back. I mean, it was a crisis, and the husband and the wife, the mother, they were at loggerheads as to what to do, and it appeared as though they were not going to be able to resolve this thing in the right way. But I want to come back and have Dr. Julie explain exactly how it did get resolved. But first, my studio is telling me, my engineer, that we must break for a commercial. Can you stand by, Dr. Julie?
Definitely. All right. Yeah.
First, I want to mention again that this show is being brought to you by Murtaugh Construction. They point out that one in every three houses that is sold are sold in the fall. And Paul Murtaugh, who has been in this business for over 30 years, says that often people are surprised when they put their house up and they get visitors, they get people come in, and a buyer will order an inspection report, and all of a sudden there's a big surprise. He said, our company is in business to handle that surprise. We've been handling surprises like this for 30 years, so we are the people to call if that stands in the way of your closing on your home. Also, he said people want to put the house up for sale and they know it doesn't have enough curb appeal and they want some interior remodeling or even exterior remodeling. He asked that we go to his website to see some of the before and after, astonishing pictures actually, of people who have done that and then gone on to sell their home for increased value. The Murtaugh brothers have been doing this, as we say, for over 30 years in Westchester and Bucks County, Montgomery County, Chester County. They are just really, really terrific company and great people. And Paul Murtaugh, of course, puts his name on every single job and is on premise for every single job. And I would suggest that if you have a situation like that where you're going to put your house up for sale or you want to do some remodeling, please call the Murtaugh brothers at 610-359-1979. That's 610-359-1979, or email them at murtaughbrothers@gmail.com, and you will be on your way to taking care of your problems.
This is Linda Purcell. I listen to In His Sign Catholic Radio every chance I get. Kathleen convicts me with the words of our Lord. Kathleen lives in His love, and for me, just the opportunity to listen to her is my road to Emmaus. My heart is burning for our Lord Jesus. I am set on fire each time I tune in His Sign Catholic Radio. Why don't you give it a try, too?
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio. Empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We often think of the scripture where the disciples were walking to Emmaus, where they said, "Were not our hearts burning within us as Jesus spoke to us on the road?" As we travel along the road together in our Archdiocese of Philadelphia and Camden Diocese, we thank God for our loyal, circle of family and friends. Please consider sponsoring one of our new programs in the name of your parish priest, family member, or friend. It would be a beautiful way of helping us to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, our risen Lord. Give us a call at 610-527-2906 or visit us on the web at inhissign.com.
Okay, we're back with the amazing, incredible Dr. Julie Asuzu, a medical doctor studying to be an attorney, a mother of 8 children, an author of about 11 books as I count them, including the amazing Every Child is a Blessing Saved by an Angel of Light, which recounts the most extraordinary story I think you're ever going to hear or read. And we're kind of in the middle of it. Julie is bringing us up to date. She's an undergraduate at Cheney University. She has 2 children. She's working 3 jobs. Her husband working 2 jobs. They discover that they're expecting a 3rd child. There's no way they can afford to have a 3rd child. They discuss having an abortion. Julie just cannot bring herself to do it. The husband is insisting, and he is the man of her dreams, and he's a good man. But he just cannot see any way that the family will not go under, end up on the street, or God forbid worse. And they are struggling in crisis as to how to resolve this issue. Dr. Julie, please pick it up from that point.
So after went to the, the story in the book actually says how we got there and the fact that I had cold feet and left. When I got home, I resolved at that particular time that I would preserve the life of my baby. You have to remember, this is back in 1986. There was no Google back then. Right. The only thing that was available was the Yellow Pages. So I made the Yellow Pages book a constant companion. I went through every line that had the word pregnancy attached to it, and I called as many numbers as I could. Unfortunately, everybody I called had the same notion. I remember, meaning the same notion, go ahead and have an abortion. I remember one lady in particular who said, "You are still young. Go ahead and do it. After college, you can have more babies." Brian, at that time, she seemed to make sense. But that was until my very last phone call. That phone call, I got the voice of a man who said hello. There was something about his hello, something very special about that hello. He asked me what my problem was. I told him, but I was crying through almost every word I was saying. So being a very patient, almost a sadly person, we arranged to meet. And we met in front of Mercy Catholic. And when I met him, he asked me what the problem was. I went in detail, explained to him, but I told him that he needed to talk to my husband. And he asked if there was a way he could meet him. I told him I would try. So I got home and I told my husband that I met this man, and his name is Dr. George Isaiah.
Our listeners know him well.
Yes. My husband reluctantly agreed to meet him. And when we met Dr. Isaiah the first time, we couldn't get anywhere. We couldn't arrive at any amicable conclusion. Then, and this is where Father John McFadden came into the picture. Dr. Tsai, you knew that we were Catholic, my husband and I, and he believed that meeting Father McFadden could make a difference. So we went over and visited him. We talked, we discussed, again, a lot of details about this in the book. And again, we couldn't get anywhere. So eventually, I think it was a few days after meeting Father McFadden, Dr. Tsai, you called for another meeting. And at that meeting, it was obvious that our problem was the fact that we were struggling with the two children that we had. We were students. We were working. We couldn't make ends meet. And there was just no way we could afford a third baby. And this is really where this whole story took a very positive turn. Dr. Isayu, at that point, made a commitment without any coercion, nothing. He made a commitment and a promise that he would provide everything we needed to take care of that unborn child. Now, you can imagine how that made me feel. I felt like I was in a dream. I felt like, could this be real? Because all I needed was somebody who would support me, not just financially, but who would say, it's okay, what you're trying to do is the right thing. Right. And this man did that, meaning Dr. Isayu did that. And from that moment on, I was able to carry that baby to term without any fear, any concerns, or any worry, and continued school, because at that point I was still in school, and continued going to school. Now, it's very possible for people to listen to the story and say, well, he just did what pro-lifers did. I don't believe at that point that Dr. Tsai, and this is something that only he knows, that he was under the umbrella of any organization. This was something he wanted to do. And I wasn't the first woman he had helped. I believe there was somebody else he helped. I think I was the second or the third. Mm-hmm. But all the resources for what he did, I believe, came directly from him. And he made the commitment to do this. Now, he didn't just do this and say, okay, here, this is what you need, medical bills, diapers, formula, furniture, all of that will be provided. No. He stayed consistent. He visited the house. He visited the children. He visited my husband. As a matter of fact, with time, he almost became a family friend. He became a family friend to the family. And sometimes he would bring, like, my vitamins to the house because we had limited mobility. So he would physically buy the vitamins and come to the house and bring it. This is an extraordinary human being. It's difficult to put in words what he did. Now, remember that he didn't stop with me. Sometime in this process, my situation happened in 1986. Somewhere in this process, he ended up taking in 28 pregnant women into his house with his beautiful wife, Pat Isayu. And a lot of people can imagine what happens when you have one pregnant woman in the house. Try to multiply that 28 times. And that's what Dr. Isayu did. And of course, later on, he set up the place now that we know that he has many more. And over the years, he has saved over 1,000 unborn babies.
Wow. Extraordinary. And to your point, this was 5 years that he established Mother's Home, 5 years after meeting you and helping you. So
exactly,
it's extraordinary. He, you know, it was just a Christian love, really, more than anything else, reaching out to another and helping two people, different countries, different races, different genders, different backgrounds, different experiences, different everything, but one thing in common: Christ, a deep Christian love in the heart of both people. He helped. Christ saved you and your marriage and your family and your future through this doctor. He goes on to institutionalize that program in Mother's Home. Mm-hmm. And today, 25 years later, over 1,000 children of circumstance, born in circumstance not dissimilar to your own, Dr. Julie, have been saved. Over a thousand lives. Extraordinary.
Over a thousand.
Absolutely extraordinary. And I, you know, you write powerfully about three lessons that you learned from this experience. And I thought it was powerful. You know, number one, you write, when you think there's no hope left, don't give up. Your next turn may reveal the next solution, your solution. Second, one person can make a huge difference. And we see that now in your life and in your commitment. And finally, you say, you know, the choices we make today can pretty much determine the kind of legacy we leave tomorrow. Three very important lessons. And I think they must be at the heart of your work now, your call to be a motivational spirit to others.
Yes, it is. Again, Dr. Sayu is very exemplary, but even way beyond exemplary. I would probably just stop short of calling him a saint. He's very humble and doesn't even want this recognition or this. But it's very difficult. They say people who bring sunshine to others cannot keep it away from themselves. Dr. Sayu brought sunshine to me and to over a thousand mothers and children. It's difficult for me to share my story without really shining the spotlight on him for what he has done. I'm just one voice sharing what he did for me. You can imagine if those 1,000 plus women share the same story that Dr. Sayu, you know, share
yes.
their experience of what he did for them. I want to mention that that child from that pregnancy is now a biomedical engineer. That is the great news about this whole story. And I also want to share that I did talk to her about this story, because this is a very difficult story, in a way, for somebody to come out publicly to share this. However, I am moved by the Holy Spirit, who said, look, you're a beneficiary of this, and all you have to do is encourage others, share it with others, and hopefully motivate others to take this route of giving, of doing for others, of sacrificing for others, of making the world a better place. And you did say that, you did mention that one of the things that I learned from this whole experience was really that one person can make a big difference in the life of so many. If this man can do this for one person, I mean, for 1,000 women and children, imagine what 1,000 people can do if they just do just a certain percentage of what he did. And that is what my goal here is. My goal is to get as many people as possible, first of all, to read this book, because they will understand what I'm talking about regarding the work of Dr. Sayu. They will understand also better my history and how I got to where I am now. But also, I want them to go further. I want them to do something to make the world a better place. I want them to help people who are in need. As I said at the beginning of the show, you just never know that person that you will help. You never know that person, that child, that woman will help so many other people and might even help you or help your own descendants somewhere down the road.
It's also very true, Doctor. I have to ask, you know, you go on to become a physician, and I wonder, was it the example of Dr. George Sayu that inspired you to do that?
No. I've given him many credits, but no, realistically, no, it wasn't him. But I would say that probably that encouraged me to some point. No, my decision to become a physician was something that happened when I was a child. My grandfather, Papa, in the story.
Diabetes, yes.
Was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes when he was, I believe, in his late 60. And at that point, remember back then, they didn't have the medical technology and everything that's available right now to even make those diagnoses. Three of his brothers have died, three of his brothers died when they were in their maybe 40s,
yes,
early 40s, early 50s. And nobody knew why they died. But later on, when my grandfather was diagnosed, and he was lucky because one of my aunts, his daughter, was a nurse and kind of recognized the symptoms of diabetes in him. I said, hey, you need to get checked. And she made it possible for that diagnosis to be done. And once it was diagnosed, he needed to change his diet. And then he was placed on insulin injections. Well, he had lost his eyesight. And my grandmother was getting very old, had arthritis, and wasn't, you know, very educated. But for some reason, my grandfather trusted that I could learn how to give him, do the AccuCheck, the insulin, the blood glucose level check, and also give him his dose of insulin. So he had the doctors teach me how to do that. I must have been around 8, 9, somewhere around there.
Wow.
And really, I didn't want to let him down. So I learned. I, you know, immersed myself in this training, and I learned how to check his blood glucose level before breakfast, before lunch, before dinner. And I also learned how much insulin to give him, IM, which is subcutaneous under the skin, morning and evening. So, and actually doing that helped him live another 10 years before he died.
How many years?
So, 10 more years.
Wow, okay, all right. Wow, that's beautiful.
So, yes, he extended his life, possibly 10 more years, because he died 8 to 10 years after the diagnosis. He could have died sooner if he, you know, didn't have that opportunity. But the point of my story was, once I realized that I could make that difference in a person, even though that was somebody that I loved so much, that was very close to me, I realized that, you know what, I could do more. I could, just by becoming a physician or being involved in the medical profession, that I could really save life. And also remember that when I was a kid, I had seen children of my age die from starvation, from childhood diseases. So all of that together, I believe, were the reasons that I actually went into the medical field. But yes, I wouldn't say doctors, I didn't have any influence. Probably at that point, I realized, okay, this dream could still be actualized. Look at what he's also doing. But at no point do I ever think I could accomplish what he has accomplished. I hope, I pray I could, because I know that would make him happy. But he's a very extraordinary human being.
Well, you know, so are you. Here you are with your fourth child. You leave the Philadelphia suburbs. You move with your three children to Hershey. You invite one of your children's great aunts to live with you and care for your children while you go back to school. Your fourth child's born 2 days prior to starting medical school. You graduate medical school, sleeping about 3 hours a day for those 4 years. Mm-hmm. You immediately set up a residency and then a medical practice after that. Your population, patient population, grows quickly. You practice medicine for a decade, and then all of a sudden, you feel drawn to a medical mission in Africa. You leave the country, and you go back to Africa. What drew you back? How long did you stay, and what brought you back here?
I still believe, when I was talking at the beginning, when you gave the introduction, I said it's where the Holy Spirit moves you. When your heart is called to do something, and you listen, and you know that what you want to do is not self-centered, is not you're not doing it for your own self actualization. You're doing it because there's a calling. That was part of the reason why I can remember as early as I think my first or my second year of residency, I wanted to go on medical mission in Africa. However, that was not the right time. There were a lot of other things going on. But at this particular time, it was somewhere in 2007, I had the opportunity to do this. And I felt I needed to do it.
What part of Africa, doctor, did you go to?
I went to a place called Abuja. It's the capital of Nigeria.
Oh, wow.
It was through the Catholic Archdiocese, yes. And we went to, from church to church, village to village. It was just, remember I had left, you know, when I was 16 in my teens. And then going back, you know, 10, 20 years after, 20, 30 years almost after, was an eye-opener. A lot of the medical conditions that, you know, we easily diagnosed here, have treatment or available treatment for those who don't have those resources. But it was one of the most fulfilling things that I've done in my life. I came back for many reasons, but one of them was the Boko Haram was really terrorizing the Catholic Christian community in that area. And it became, it got to a point where safety became an issue. I had to return for that reason. And then, of course, for some other personal family reasons.
Well, you come back. What year is it that you come back? Because shortly thereafter, you take off again on another mission where we find you today down in Florida, Naples, studying to be a lawyer at Ave Maria Law School.
It was in 2012 I returned. And at that point, there were some personal issues that I had to resolve. And I, those things are resolved now and taken care of. But right after that, I felt, before that, when I went on, when I was on medical mission service, I felt that I didn't know a lot of laws, like legal issues. I didn't know international laws. I didn't know about patent laws that, you know, relate to medications, whether they can be available in Africa or Asia or any other country. I had very poor knowledge of the law. And I at that point, made the decision that I could probably be a better physician if I had a legal background. Not to say that every physician needs a legal background to be, just because of the things that I want to do. So I decided that, you know, I could do both. And it's one of the best decisions that I've made. I love law school, especially my school, Ave Maria School of Law. It's one of the, it's actually the most devout Christian school,
yes.
Catholic school
yes,
in the
is.
United States.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, right now I'm taking just a temporary leave of absence with the permission of my dean so that I could finish these books that you were listing. I don't believe they're 11. But yes, my goal is to do 12 before I go back, and which should be very soon. I have about a year, and I have tops 2 years to get my JD, and I'm looking forward to finishing it and graduating in about 2 years or less.
Well, so, Dr. Julie, you are the most remarkable individual that we have met on this show, Our Recourse. We ask, would you please come back when you finish and tell us about some of the other books and your new work?
Definitely. I would be very glad to. And you've been an awesome host. The listeners, I just hope and pray, meaning your audience, I hope and pray that you were able to take something positive out of this interview that I had with Brian. I want to reach out now to any woman, whether young woman or married woman like I was, who is pregnant and considering abortion.
Doctor, I'm getting a signal. We only have 30 seconds left. I'm going to ask anybody who wants to get in touch with Dr. Julie to call In His Sign Network at 610-527-2906. Ask for the book. We'll send you the book. Go on to her website, an extraordinary website, and learn more about Dr. Julie and her incredible work. We want to thank her. We want to thank In His Sign Network, as always, and Kathleen McCarthy. And we want to thank Murtaugh Construction for sponsoring this show. And all of you for listening to it. Please come back again next Monday at 4 o'clock. We love having you, and we love having incredible guests like Dr. Julie James Isuzu. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.